Gay rights and religious freedoms have been described as a zero-sum game, a losing battle, and, at best, a marriage of necessity. But is that a fair assessment? On May 28, 2014, Moment Magazine, partnering with the Freedom Institute of the Newseum, put these two cagey beasts in a room together to see if they could reach a truce. Our diverse set of panelists turned first to history for guidance, discussing the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1997. The 1993 Act was aimed at preventing laws that substantially burden a person's free exercise of their religion. They then took us on a tour of religious protection laws in Kansas, Arizona, and Mississippi. Next, they explained the major legal precedents in the battle over adoption rights, health care, and, of course, gay marriage, and debated the role of the states. Race even entered the conversation as panelists asked what lessons could be learned from the history of race and the civil rights movement in America. While the charged conversation hardly ended in resolution, we found bright spots, moments of understanding, spaces bridged, and, hopefully, a little common ground. Thank you for listening. To comment, send emails to editor@momentmag.com. That's editor@momentmag.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Ann Lewis. I am vice chair of the Moment Magazine Advisory Board, which means I get the delight of welcoming everyone this evening. And let me say how happy Moment is to partner yet again on another important conversation with the Religious Freedom Center of the Newseum Institute. Thank you. Tonight's symposium, Gay Rights and Religious Freedom, was carefully put together, as I think you're going to see, to represent many aspects of this important issue. For Moment itself, which is that rare entity these days, an independent publication committed to exploring a wide spectrum of Jewish ideas, experience, and culture, or as we say, the next 5,000 years of conversation begins here. Moment was co-founded in 1975 by Nobel Prize laureate Elie Wiesel and is the flagship project of the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Center for Creative Change. You can find out more about Moment, especially that important information about how to subscribe, by going to momentmag.com. And if you go there, you will also be able to listen to a podcast in a few days of tonight's event, so you can rehear all the good parts. Also, all the parts, I should say, and think of more questions. And I also want to thank Charles Haynes, my colleague here for the Religious Freedom Center of the Newseum Institute, for partnering with us again on such an important conversation. I want to thank Nadine Epstein, who I think is in here somewhere, editor and publisher of Moment, she's back there, and Ashley Hampton and Johanna Roskin for helping to put together tonight's program. And there's just one more point I'd like to make. It's so appropriate that we're having this discussion on the newest frontier of human rights in a year in which we mark the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, which was another frontier of human rights. At Moment, we plan a year-long commemoration of the work of Jews and civil rights organizations and activists together. It will begin in our summer issue, 50 years from now, as our nation looks back on the progress we will then have made on gay rights, and children wonder, what was all that about? Why did they think people were different? I think discussions like the one we are going to have tonight will be one of the highlights of that year. So I thank you all very much for coming, and I'm going to introduce tonight's moderator. You've already heard about him, Dr. Charles Haynes, who is the director of the Religious Freedom Center of the Newseum Institute. He is a senior scholar at the First Amendment Center, and he is also the author or co-author of 6 books, including First Freedoms, A Documentary History of First Amendment Rights in America, and Religion in American Public Life. So please take a magazine with you when you go, and take it away, Charles.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to move the podium so that you all can have better sight lines over here. So just give us a second for that. And I think you all got the biographies, so that I won't have to do that. All right, I'm eliminating things as I go along here. Th- Thank you, Anne. It's very good of you to come and introduce the program tonight on behalf of Moment. And we are delighted to be collaborating again with Moment Magazine. It's always a wonderful partnership, great discussions, and I'm sure tonight's will be as well. So I want to add my welcome to we're at the Knight Conference Center, not only to all of those of you who came here in person, but also to all joining online. We're delighted. You can tweet your questions. What is the hashtag? Is the hashtag just the name of the program? I think that's right. The hashtag is, I think, gay rights, religious freedom. That's the hashtag? Okay, good. So we will look forward to getting your tweets by your questions by tweet. Well, let me just make a few comments about what we're going to talk about tonight. Not much, but just to say that, as you well know, in recent months, legislators in more than a dozen states, from Hawaii to Georgia, have proposed laws that they describe as being necessary to protect religious freedom. Now, some of these laws are broad Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, which we'll talk about it in a minute, and they're very similar to laws that are already on the books in many states. Others are amendments to existing laws, and apparently the motivation behind this is to find a way to allow businesses to deny wedding services to same-sex couples on religious grounds. That precipitated a lot of this activity, as I understand it, in many of these states. Well, and all of this is driven, as you well know, by the growing public support for same-sex marriage and LGBT rights. And that's reflected, of course, most powerfully in recent days, really. Just every day something changes in a series of court decisions favoring challenges to bans on same-sex marriage. I just turned mine off, so if you still have yours on, don't you turn. This actually happened to me once I was moderating, and mine went off, so please turn off yours. Now, in calmer times, many of these bills that have been so controversial this spring might have faced little or no opposition. After all, the original Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993, which Mark Stern helped to author, passed Congress almost unanimously and was signed into law by President Clinton. What's changed, of course, is this growing public support for LGBT rights and same-sex marriage. So those who were once in the majority on these issues are now in the minority, at one time successfully passing constitutional amendments and laws banning gay marriage. So in this new environment, many religious conservatives are asking or seeking to put in place legal requirements for seeking exemption from laws that prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. So that's the backdrop. And not surprisingly, emotions are running high as this is going on around the country. What some see as necessary protection for religious conscience, others decry as bigotry and discrimination. So tonight, we hope to have a robust but civil dialogue about LGBT rights and religious freedom. It's a very complex, and I'll turn to you for your questions as soon as we can, so please know that we're not going to keep you out of it, but it's a big topic, but we'll have to sort of lay some of the foundation. We're going to try to discover if there is any common ground and how, if is it possible to balance these two values of religious freedom and non-discrimination or equality. And we have, I think, the best panel we could possibly have to try to tackle all of this. All of them are widely respected for their work on these issues, have written about these issues, have spoken about these issues. Robin, I won't do their whole bio since you have them, but Robin Fredwell Wilson is professor of law and director of the Family Law and Policy Program at the University of Illinois. And Mark Stern, who's sitting next to Robin right there, is general counsel for the American Jewish Committee. Jonathan Rauch, who's on the end there, is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. And Jay Michelson is a fellow for Political Research Associates. So, with that backdrop, to get us started, we've asked Professor Fredwell Wilson to give us an overview of the religious exemption minefield, just so that all of us are on the same page as we talk about these issues. So I'm going to turn it to you, Robin.
Okay, well, thank you, Charles. So I wanted just to spend a couple minutes situating what happened in Arizona in the larger context of gay rights and religious liberty, and those are points that I make in a forthcoming article. So if you look at the monitors, you'll see that, or if you look at the handout. And I think the first big point is that the Arizona debate was a very different animal from the primary context in which religious liberty exemptions have emerged, which is namely same-sex marriage legislation. And the bill vetoed by Governor Brewer would have amended Arizona's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, and I know Mark's going to talk more about that in a moment, to definitively speak to a question that has split the courts, namely whether commercial businesses, when they're sued by another citizen, even qualify for RFRA protection. Now, RFRA, especially before the recent debate, were basically a whole different animal. They were designed to respond to overreaching in contexts far removed from gay rights, like, for example, whether the Amish have to put orange triangles on their buggies instead of gray triangles for safety. But commentators, the media, and the public took that arcane legal question about who qualifies to mean that businesses could turn away lesbian and gays for any reason or none at all, and that those businesses would always win because of the RFRA. Now, that fundamental misunderstanding, ironically, was propelled by some religious liberty advocates themselves who said that they needed the amendment in order to, quote, stave off gay rights. Now, to be clear, there were no gay rights in Arizona, at least in Arizona state law, to stave off or somehow contain. Shamefully, Arizona does not ban sexual orientation discrimination either in its housing, its employment law, or its public accommodation laws. It's hard to fathom why they don't give that much needed protection when some municipalities and the state do. But in any event, the project of bolstering religious liberty went off the rails in Arizona precisely because religious liberty advocates had only themselves in mind. Now, I think something more constructive could have been done. The legislators could have and should have granted the LGBT community the same protections that the rest of us have in the same piece of legislation that was supposed to clarify this technical point about who has the ability to bring a RFRA claim. Now, while Arizona does not ban sexual orientation discrimination, it's remarkably different from the states where we've seen same-sex marriage legislation, and I show you them here in blue. In what I call the enacting jurisdictions, every single one of those enacting jurisdictions to recognize marriage equality in state legislation had a pre-existing sexual orientation ban. And not surprisingly, every enacting jurisdiction included meaningful, if imperfect sometimes, protections for religious objectors. Why did they include those protections? Because absent those protections, non-discrimination laws that are essentially designed to secure equal treatment in the marketplace for commercial services like buying a burger or hailing a taxi or renting a commercial apartment, those would spill over to a religiously freighted and deeply personal matter facilitating another person's marriage. And with burgers and taxis, a refusal to serve someone can only reflect animus towards that individual being denied the service, because burgers have no moral or religious content. Marriage, by contrast, is for many people a religious sacrament or religious ceremony and has been for centuries. Now, because legislators in the enacting jurisdictions did not mean to treat the refusal to facilitate a marriage like the refusal to serve a burger, they clarified that in the same piece of legislation that made marriage equality a reality, as you can see here in green. And let me pause for just a moment and note what I call the black hole states. And these are states that recognize same-sex marriage by judicial decision alone, and Charles referenced just how many of those decisions we have now. These states have precisely no additional religious liberty protections. Now, that shouldn't be a great surprise, because it's not really the court's role in that civil rights legislation to protect third parties. But the enacting jurisdictions protect refusals to facilitate another's marriage when doing so would violate deeply held religious beliefs, and you can see kind of a medley of that here. These protections extend only to marriage and provide no other basis for refusing to serve lesbian and gays. All of the states, if you look at the left column, protect the clergy, which really don't need it because of the First Amendment, a point that Mark makes very well in the book that I co-edited. And all but one go further then and protect religious organizations and their employees. One state, Delaware, protects individuals out in the world, not just inside religious organizations. Importantly, all covered objectors, however described, are protected from private suit everywhere, and nearly everywhere, from the loss of government grants or the right to contract with the state, in other words, coercion by the state. as you can see in the third column. And there the commonalities, or what I call the core protections, essentially fall apart, and we see an a la carte menu emerging among the states. Some states protect religious marriage counseling, some married student housing, others religiously affiliated fraternal organizations like the Knights of Columbus. Some protect religious social services agencies, think Catholic Charities. Delaware, which is not shown in that particular chart, allows a sitting justice of peace or a judge to refuse to celebrate any marriage without risking her job. Now, one way to envision those protections is as moving out from the church sanctuary, as shown here to the far left, to church-owned or affiliated property, and then a little bit farther to church-affiliated nonprofits at the coalface of society, like social services providers. Another step further out might be public employees and judges and justices of the peace who receive protection in Delaware. But then finally, we come to the nub of the debate in Arizona, actual commercial businesses. No enacting jurisdiction to date has reached that far. And the exemptions proposed by a group of scholars that includes me and my co-author, Doug Laycock, would reach wedding industry professionals, but only for refusals to celebrate the wedding, and then only if small mom-and-pop businesses with 5 employees or less. And even then, we believe that the right to refuse must be qualified by hardship to same-sex couples. Now, some argue that religious liberty is in tension with gay rights. But in every enacting jurisdiction to date, religious liberty protections have served as a pathway to marriage equality, not as a roadblock to it. No longer paper shows that by looking at vote counts in different jurisdictions and with interviews from legislators in each of them. But here's just one example, Maryland, where the successful bill passed after augmenting protections over 2 different legislative cycles, and even then it passed only by the closest of margins. And those religious liberty protections mattered. Here's Maryland House Speaker Michael Bush saying that he knows for a fact that those protections mattered to the outcome. And then that brings us to our discussion today.
Thank you. And Robin has provided, I think everyone has, these handouts so that you can follow. Did everyone get those? We have copies. If you didn't, let us know, because we have extras around somewhere. But so that you can follow along. No, it's just, they're separate handouts. They should have been on your... Okay. Mark, you, as I mentioned, were one of the key people behind the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in the very beginning, and when it was drafted.
I shouldn't use that phrase in the beginning. Older than I already am.
Yeah, well, it was a while ago. But you were a key force behind the original RFRA, as we call it. Now there are state Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. Could you help us all understand why RFRA plays a role in this current debate, and from your perspective, what is that role? I mean, Robin alluded to it a little bit, but just so people can understand kind of the landscape.
Sure. From 1963-64 on, the Supreme Court had said that any time a government regulation interferes with a person's practice of religion, whether or not that interference was intentional or not, and whether or not religion was singled out, the government had a duty to come forward with evidence to show that it had a compelling interest in burdening religion. That's how everybody read the court's decisions. That's how every casebook read the court's decisions. That's how the court read the court's decisions. In 1991, in a rather funny fact pattern, 2 Native Americans who were drug counselors at a drug rehabilitation center were fired because they ingested peyote as part of their Native American church rituals. This went to the Supreme Court once on a side issue. It comes back. The state of Oregon simply urges, in keeping with the earlier decision, they had a compelling interest in drug counselors not using narcotic drugs. To everybody's surprise, with the exception of one amicus brief, nobody thought the issue was up before the court. The court said, well, you've all been mistaken all these years. We've never held that religious liberty, the interference with religious practice requires any special burden of justification by the government. The proof is the cases in which we upheld the suppression of the Mormon church in the 19th century over polygamy. That left everybody astounded. The Attorney General of Oregon was apologizing right and left. We didn't ask for this. And we decided to put back into place the original standard, which was, regardless of the government's intention and regardless of whether religion has been singled out, to require the government to prove with evidence that it had a compelling interest in creating any particular burden on religious liberty. The idea was a statute that replicated the Constitution. Now, we made, in retrospect, one assumption that was unwarranted, and a second, I think we just took for granted. It was in the air, and I'll cut the two of them. The two issues are these. The first is, are corporations entitled to invoke the statute? In fact, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, there were a couple of cases involving Sunday Blue Laws, which were brought by corporations to challenge the Blue Laws on a variety of grounds, Establishment Clause, Equal Protection, and Free Exercise. Free Exercise claim was brought by a Jewish Sabbath observer who claimed that his religious ability to practice his religion, observe the Sabbath, was substantially undercut because he had to be closed 2 days a week. His competitors were only closed 1 day a week. And it's hard to believe there was actually a time in living memory where you couldn't shop on Sunday, but there it was. And the court rejected the claim on the merits. It did not say you're a corporation, you don't have free exercise rights. It just said that their government has an important reason which justifies the burden. So we sort of took that for granted. The word person is defined in something called the Dictionary Act, which is another obscure piece of legislation. It's one U.S. code. It's the very first volume of the federal statutes that, in order to spare Congress the difficulty of actually saying what it means, it provides that certain words have defined meanings unless there's some indication something else is meant. And the word person is defined as including corporations unless the context indicates otherwise. So we sort of I distinctly remember that we knew of that statute, we discussed it, and did not feel it was necessary. There were already in the air cases about corporations invoking religious liberty rights in civil rights cases. Specifically, this sounds quaint too, the issue du jour then was unmarried couples wanting to rent apartments and landlords having religious objections to renting to people who were living together, as we used to say, in sin or without the benefit of clergy or whatever. So those cases were around. They'd been divisive, but they did not somehow command everybody's attention because there were just a few of them. So that's one issue, and that's clearly one of the issues that's involved both in the Arizona statute and, of course, in the Hobby Lobby case, which is pending down the block. The second issue was whether in a lawsuit not between the government and a private party seeking to enforce a federal statute, but in which a private party sues another private party to seek enforcement of a statute, whether that was covered by RFRA. And frankly, if the question had been posed to us, I think we would have laughed, because the case that establishes the principle that government action in deciding a lawsuit is state action is none other than New York Times v. Sullivan. Sullivan was not the government. I mean, he was a government official, but he wasn't acting in a governmental capacity when he sued the New York Times. And the court took it for granted that both, a corporation could invoke First Amendment rights, and secondly, that the fact that there was no government seeking to enforce a slander rule was irrelevant because it was the government that was deciding the case and the person of the court. That constituted state action. That was sufficient to trigger the First Amendment. Quite certain that if the issue had been raised, we would have said to you, New York Times v. Sullivan is conclusive. Somehow, that has become unsettled. Long before the dispute over Hobby Lobby and long before the dispute over gay rights, that issue surfaced in a series of cases, both involving the bankruptcy law, age discrimination cases, and the courts have split on the answer to that question because, actually, it's a no good deed goes unpunished. We were actually intending to circumvent what the court has done in the name of the 10th Amendment, which is to say you can't sue a state unless Congress says so very explicitly. So we wrote into RFRA language that said this allows all appropriate remedies against the government, thinking of the 10th Amendment problem. Some courts have read that to mean, but not a remedy against private parties, which certainly, I mean, in all the conversations, nobody thought that that's what we meant. But that has divided the circuits. It divided the circuits before the gay rights issue really became the hot button issue. And so the Arizona discussion, which is, of course, motivated by what you've just heard described, really, I mean, it also solves a problem that exists in RFRA because of a litigation, and would be an interesting question to debate. Absent, if you took it out of the gay rights context, we'd have an interesting discussion. So it's not, you know, it's not only about gay rights. It fits into a larger framework, and that's pretty much where we are. There were efforts to get state RFRAs after the federal RFRA was passed. Another one of my brilliant prophecy jobs. I, at the time, remember saying to people, this is a waste of time and energy, not predicting that the RFRA would be thrown out as applied to the states. After the Supreme Court said that RFRA couldn't be applied to state legislation, I think it's 11, 12 now, state 20?
Think 19 or 20.
19 or 20 yeah. have passed it. That movement has now stalled, basically, over the same-sex marriage, gay rights issue, but it fills what we thought we had filled with RFRA, so that it applied both to the same standard applied to federal and state action. Supreme Court in 1996 said it couldn't apply to state action, so states went back and passed legislation or by state constitutional decision to fill that gap. That movement has now stopped because every time you raise the issue, the same-sex marriage issue arises. However, not only in Ohio recently, the dispute was not over same-sex marriage. It was about teachers, a case in which a teacher used his position to try and proselytize in the classroom. And the opposition to RFRA, which I don't think was justified because those cases can be brought with or without RFRA, was that would encourage more such cases. So there's a bunch of things that now come up. But that's the background.
So as you can see, it's a complex landscape, and we now have these various state RFRAs on the books, others being proposed, but as Mark suggests, just like the National RFRA Coalition fell apart, really I think largely over some of the issues we're talking about tonight, so in many states now, these efforts to push these state RFRAs, which would have probably gone through pretty easily at one time, are stalled. So before we get into the specific thing, I'd like to talk a little bit about Arizona a little more deeply before we move from Arizona. But Jonathan and Jay, I want to give you a chance to comment on the overall landscape as you see it. When this started coming up, how did you think about the tensions that were arising over these proposals for RFRAs in different states? What was your reaction, and what did you hope might happen that did or didn't happen, and which of you like?
So I guess, first of all, thank you for including me in the panel. I think I'd quibble, Charles, with just one bit about your introduction, which is what's changed from the federal RFRA to the present moment, and the answer being the advent of the LGBT equality movement. I think there are actually significant changes in the way that RFRA itself is being promoted and is being understood. So first, you know, the typical RFRA case, excuse me, in the beginning was exactly, you know, what Mark said. So a minority religious practice having only a diffuse harm on the majority. All right, so there is some harm having a drug treatment counselor potentially using a psychoactive substance, but it's religious, but it's a minority religious practice and a diffuse harm on a majority. Contemporary RFRA cases tend to be the majority religious rights having a very concentrated harm on a minority, in this case sexual or gender minorities, or on reproductive freedom. So it's actually, to me, inverted, that what we're talking about is the opposite kinds of cases from what I think the broad coalition that supported RFRA had in mind. And so that broad coalition had in mind a particular kind of fact pattern, and that's why it was so broad, and it brought together folks who were religious conservatives and folks who were civil libertarians to unite around that issue. Second, the notion that RFRA would really be used as a sword rather than a shield, a sword against third parties, I don't think was part of the original coalition that supported RFRA. I mean, Mark was there. I was also very tangentially there. I was actually an intern on the Hill working for Congressman Gerald Nadler. His legislative director was involved in the construction of RFRA. But that broad coalition enacted a shield for religious minorities against state action, not necessarily thinking of it as a sword for one private actor to use against another. And finally, I think that the third piece that's really important to kind of get about Arizona was where the who were the people who were backing RFRA and what the agenda, what their stated agendas were. So following the money and following the sort of who was behind a lot of the actions, there were folks who were not necessarily civil libertarians, but were Christian conservatives seeking to continue the same kind of culture war type battles that had been fought for a long time. And just looking at who's on the roster, the majority of those people actually were pursuing a particular social end. And so I think those are significant differences, not just the obviously the significant changes in same-sex marriage, but also the changes on the other side in the way that RFRA is understood and who was actually promoting it. It was interesting in Arizona that it did come to a head precisely in such an unusual situation where there were no protections to get out of.
Right.
It is kind of an unusual test case. And it's also a little disturbing that the light that was shed on Arizona didn't cause a lot of outcry about the lack of anti-discrimination protection. One would have hoped that all of this media attention might have said, geez, Arizona, maybe you could kind of get with the program on,
right,
on anti-discrimination. That didn't really happen. But what did happen was a significant sociological change in terms of the role of corporate power, actually, in this case, on the pro-LGBT side, threatening, you know, with the NFL coming in and weighing in. And that, I think, is an interesting, less of a legal fact and more of a sociological fact, that the genie is now really out of the bottle. So much so that the mainstream LGBT equality movement is no longer in control of the genie. So, you know, where we saw in heads of technology companies, you know, being fired or asked to leave on the basis of past support of Prop 8, for example, that movement did not come from the mainstream LGBT movement, but from kind of the fringes. And yet, the genie out of the bottle metaphor, or maybe the sorcerer's apprentice, that now there's this kind of momentum that I think we saw really take place in Arizona.
Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, I'm an openly gay man. I'm married. I'm an Arizonan, born and raised. I'll be there next week. So I know a bit about the state. I've watched this landscape for a long time. I'm unusual because I am both a gay marriage nut, I've been promoting it now since 1995, and a religious liberty nut. I think the First Amendment is our founding freedom, and religious conscience is the founding principle of the American Republic. And what I see your situation is not limited to gay marriage. We also see it on contraception, and we'll see it in other cases, in which you've got a tension between religious liberty and other rights. In the case of gay marriage, it's primarily what we see isn't marriage per se. It's a conflict between anti-discrimination law, which says you serve all your customers, you deal with everyone, you don't discriminate, and religious liberty, which says, wait a minute, I don't want to be a party to something that I regard as deeply offensive in my religion. My view on that has always been that the answer is reasonable religious accommodations, that the way to work that out is primarily at the state and local level. There's no reason that Massachusetts and Texas need to do the same thing. These should be community standards, and people, not everyone will agree on everything, and not all states should look alike. And until recently, I was telling people that process was going pretty well. As Robin said, what you had was a process where in order to advance gay rights in many states, you had to have a negotiation over compromises with religious folks, and both sides in the long run, I think, benefit from that. I think that helps put gay rights on a more sustainable footing. People are less alarmed about it. Gay people don't look like bullies who are intolerant. And religious people are also less alarmed and thus, in the long run, more accepting of us. That started to go off the rails recently, and I'm worried about it. We saw it first in Kansas, which proposed a very sweeping law that didn't pass. Then in Arizona, which proposed the law which almost passed, which was less sweeping, more reasonable, but I think still wrongheaded. And then a state none of us have mentioned, Mississippi, which passed a law, in fact, very much like the Arizona law. What these laws do is come in a situation, it's not an accommodation, it's not a two-sided deal. It's one side coming in and said, you know what, we want all the marbles. We will do absolutely nothing for gay and lesbian people in this state. Not only can they not get married, there are no civil unions, there are domestic partnerships, and they can be fired for being gay. But we will have robust protections for religious folks who don't want to deal with them for whatever reason. The problem with that is it's radically unbalanced. And the problem with being radically unbalanced is once one side says, you know what, actually, what we really want is to take all the marbles and go home, the other side will do the same. This will poison the well for the kind of negotiations that we have to have going forward. And that is a concern. And by the way, I think religious folks will be hurt the most by that. What they are doing with this campaign is tarring religion with the brush of discrimination. What they're saying is that the first priority for religious people is to be able to discriminate. That is terrible messaging.
So I like Jonathan's analysis. I wish it were true. But in states where there were efforts to support same-sex marriage and provide religious accommodation, the LGBT groups have basically drawn the line at the minister. Those of us, not in my present capacity, but in prior capacity, I joined in the efforts Robin and Doug and others have made, and there was no traction.
Mark, are you saying, just to make sure, be clear,
I'm saying that
you're saying that the compromises made in those states were insufficient to protect religious freedom?
I think they're insufficient. Personally, it's not an agency position.
No.
It is equally true that my writing, in which I have supported same-sex marriage and called for religious exemption, has gotten me only brickbats from the LGBT community. It has not produced any discussion of compromise. And so I think there's a lot of blame to go around. I wish it were true that reasonable people could come to some compromise. In fact, since after RFRA was struck down and we tried to get another statute passed, the Religious Liberty Coalition that worked the first time split over those who wanted to carve out all civil rights entirely and those who wanted to apply the RFRA test. And that brings me to some comments about the Arizona law. First of all, reading the newspapers about the Arizona law, you would never know that the statute did not say you may discriminate against gays. What it said was, if you have a religious objection to participating in it, again, I take the context that it's not in the context of granting rights on the other side. But it said the state gets to prove there has a compelling interest, which is far, those of us who litigate in the field know, from a sure thing. Courts have found in the zoning context, for example, the right to park in front of your house to be a compelling interest. It was not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It was, you have a right to challenge the state and have the state come forward with proof. I suggest that if you read most of the journalism about the statute, you will never see that. That's discouraging. Finally, the majority-minority point, which has never been a favorite of mine, either on the Establishment Clause side or on the Free Exercise Clause, because they're really... I mean, there are a few counties, if you look at the religion atlas of the United States, that have a predominant majority. But there are fewer and fewer of those. Whether conservatives who don't want to serve at a gay marriage cater it or photograph it or what have you, provide a wedding cake, or majority or minority, really is irrelevant, I think, to whether their religious liberty rights are impinged or not. And I would say to you, the fact that business in Arizona opposed the statute, no matter what the polls show about who the majority is and who the majority is, that sort of shakes, it makes that a very weak analysis, because it was the business community that essentially persuaded the governor to veto the bill. It wasn't a matter of principle on either side. So exactly what a majority and minority means in that context is entirely unclear. And again, much of what the business community said, whether the bill should have been vetoed or not is a separate question, was just not rational public debate. What they said was it'll hurt our businesses. Well, if you didn't want to discriminate against gays, the bill didn't make you. It simply said those businesses, which I think will be few and far between, who wanted to got a chance at litigating. Didn't say you have to, but you'd never know that from reading the story. It's another, and I'm sure I could find stuff on the religious right if I were looking that would, you know, be equally misleading on that side. So
could you give just Mark, before you leave this point, could you give an example of what you think is missing? What's missing in states that have tried to give religious liberty protection and same-sex marriage legalization?
I think what's missing is, again, I speak for myself, but it has become the conversation stopper when you say that's discrimination. Oh yeah, it's discrimination. The question is discrimination always inevitably so bad that we're not even going to consider as against it other rights?
Right. I meant by example. I mean, in New York, for example,
New York.
What should they have put in there that they didn't put
in? I don't have each of these statutes.
Or any state that you want to.
In New York, there were proposals, and they were backed by religious groups that had previously opposed same-sex marriage, and said to the legislature, "We will withdraw that opposition if you give us robust protections." They meant small caterers. They meant even a synagogue or a Knight of Columbus that rents out its hall for weddings, which is not clearly protected under the New York statute. That got nowhere. The governor was just not listening.
Okay, that's helpful.
I wonder if we could, you know, maybe look at Robin's slide again with the concentric circles.
I wanted to do the same thing.
That reminds me of ninth grade math. Can we please avoid that?
Well, I'd like not to avoid it, because when we say, you know, I'm part of the I'm the other out gay married person on the panel. I guess are self outing, and I'm part of the ones who did raise a hue and cry when more robust religious liberty exemptions were carved out. I think if you look at the chart, I know because I've talked to the leaders of the LGBT. There's universal agreement that some of the scare tactics, Mark, that you put in your own op-eds that, you know, God forbid a rabbi or a priest would have to officiate a wedding or provide wedding counseling, as you said in your CNN editorial. There's universal agreement that's not being requested by any. There's not a single LGBT organization in the world that would say that a clergy member has to provide marriage counseling to a same-sex couple
if
they have a religious exemption.
There are people who have written that they should lose their tax exemption if they do that.
Well, where people are writing those kinds of comments, it's because the taxpayers are, in fact, subsidizing large businesses like Catholic Charities. And when if you look at the polls, when you frame the question in terms of when an organization, a religiously affiliated organization, which is tier 3 on Robin's chart, which I think the details really matter, if a religious affiliated organization is receiving public funds to provide that service, can they still discriminate in the provision of that service? So that's Catholic Charities and Adoption. When it's phrased in that way, the public support for that position saying, no, of course they shouldn't be able to discriminate if they're using public funds, that is actually off the charts. When it's flipped, of course, and said, well, this is just a religious exemption, and how dare the LGBT community not, you know, refuse to even talk to us when we're proposing a reasonable religious exemption. It's not, religious exemption is insufficiently specific as a term because it covers each of those circles on your graph.
And the circles might actually mean very different things. Like, I think that the interests that are at stake shift depending on where you are, and disguised in that is that the law to some extent already authorizes, let's say for example, government employees to step off under Title VII if even as an employee of the government, if they can be reasonably accommodated for their religious belief or practice up to an undue burden. And the Supreme Court has sort of dialed that down to mean de minimis burden, but there are cases that I collect in an article that talk about the fact that if you can staff around that person, then that person in fact does have a Title VII claim, may or may not succeed, but can go forward with it, and sometimes are accommodated by the employers. And, you know, that strikes me as really important, because if you look at the chart, you can think of moving out from the sanctuary as a way of carving the world into private religious spaces and everything else. And if you don't move out from the sanctuary itself, you're sort of strangling religious organizations in their identity. Now, we might say, fine, sue the bejesus out of them, right? They should get with the program. They need to recognize marriage equality. But there needs to be, especially at a time of great social transition, some way of allowing people to live together in peace. Now, and to some extent, graphically, the legislatures get it right, right? Because they say, look, like, it's your Baptist marriage retreat, right? That religious counseling wasn't by clergy necessarily. Sometimes it was people counseling each other. But it's saying, even though we know that these non-discrimination laws are really broad, and maybe somebody might want to sue you over this, we're just going to speak to the question right now. Religious counseling's fine. You're not going to get sued for that. Or, more importantly, because so many of these organizations are tax-exempt, not the church qua church, but the church-affiliated organization where the action is. Nobody's suing the church itself, right? It's the church religious-affiliated nonprofit that holds property or provides a service in the marketplace. That's where the action is. And those guys are tax-exempt for a lot of reasons. And some people even say they can't be taxed by the state. I don't know. I'm not a tax lawyer. But in any event, the point is, all you have to do is threaten their exemption to shut something down. Now, it's just not factually so that the religious-affiliated social service agencies are getting to take public money and not play by public rules. So there are states that have given that exemption. And three of the four states add a quid pro quo. They say, if you want to have a pass while providing a religious-affiliated adoption or foster care service and not living by the rest of the anti-discrimination law, then you may not take public money for that program. So they, in an awful metaphor, but they split the baby there, right? And some people, I think, would consider that very fair, eminently reasonable. Find them a way to continue to go forward if they want to place with heterosexual couples. Now, my personal position is, if there is a hardship to homosexual couples and being able to adopt and to make that kind of gift, amazing gift to a child, then we need to rethink that rule. But to the extent that everybody has the ability to adopt from somebody in the marketplace and public funds aren't subsidizing people who are playing by a different set of rules, then I think that's an accommodation that's justified. But people would
Robin, I'm not clear how that would work with Catholic Charities. Most people know, shut down its operation for adoption in Massachusetts. Just take that example.
Yeah, so let's go back for just a second.
So how could they have done that differently? And I want to then see what Jay would think of that.
Okay, so with Catholic Charities, they had, sadly enough, been placing children for adoption in Massachusetts for 103 years. And it's a very complicated story, but it became quickly apparent to the hierarchy of Catholic Charities that in a handful, let's say six cases, a child had been placed with a person known to be gay, not necessarily in an openly active relationship, but known to be gay. And then basically the bishops, the hierarchy of the church considered that, they flipped out. And they said, we're not doing that. That's not how we look at adoption care services. Fair enough. You know, they are in charge. And the board of the nonprofit, because the bishops, again, are the church, the board of the affiliated nonprofit en masse, am I right about this? Entire board walked out, right? In any event, the bishops stick by the policy. They go to the legislature, right, and they say, we want an exemption, because it turned out they had already been violating Massachusetts' anti-discrimination law, just didn't know it, right, when they reversed the position about placing children with openly gay persons. And so they say, we want an exemption. The legislature tells them to pack off. They ask Romney for an exemption. He tells them to go to the legislature. He was the governor at the time. So they got nowhere. And what did they do? They did what I call the nuclear option in a recent piece, which is, if you don't give people another way to step off from the mandates of the law besides closing entire operations, we see again and again and again that they will take that nuclear option as a way to solve the collision between faith and the law.
So would you have said that they should have worked out some kind of exemption for them?
Well, certainly state legislatures have, right? So they've said if before same-sex marriage is recognized, a social services provider has a policy that allows them to place only with married couples, and that, of course, at that time meant heterosexual couples, then after same-sex marriage is recognized, will permit them to continue that specific practice, but they ain't getting any public money to do it, right? And I think only Rhode Island makes an exception to that and says you can step off without it being public money. Now, it's public money for that program. That actually is sort of a weak nuclear option, though, right? So I did the math in Maryland, and 70% of Catholic Charities' budget, I think, in Maryland, I'm doing this from memory, so I may be off, had actually come from grants, you know, public funds in some way, shape, or form. And for me, I would put them to that test. I mean, that's me. Other people would in effect say, no, you should be able to take public money and have your private rule.
But isn't what happened? I guess my question is, now it's been several years on in Massachusetts, and my understanding is that now adoption services are back and up and running. They're just not contracted out to a Catholic-affiliated organization. And so it seems to me this is really basically a case of government contracting.
Right.
And it's not clear to me why a completely sincere religious organization should be receiving those government contracts if they can go elsewhere, which is my understanding is what happened in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So that allows, if Catholic Charities wants to continue doing private adoption through Catholic Charities, of course, and they should do so according to the dictates of their faith.
I think.
But the public contract, the public, but they're not. Well, they closed because they chose to close.
If memory serves, which it doesn't very much anymore, there was a licensing problem. That you couldn't get a license unless you agreed not to discriminate. So that it's not only a question of accept, and I think that was the case
right,
in Illinois as well.
Right.
So that the money question is an important one, because these charities really can't function very well without government money. But there was also a licensing problem. So even if they were willing to give up government money, they couldn't have legally provided adoptions without a license, and certainly that was the
public
case.
Public or private,
I think that's a good point.
Public or private.
I was wondering if I could. I wanted to see if I could out-liberal Jonathan for a second, because I was surprised by something you said earlier about states going. You know, we should have state-by-state solutions on these questions. You know, I'm thinking of the Heart of Atlanta case. You know, which was a religiously based challenge to anti-discriminatory civil rights laws. And ultimately, you know, this was a segregated institution in Atlanta, a well-known segregated institution that offered clear religious justifications, which I'm going to assume are sincere religious justifications for their race-based, you know, their racist policies of segregation. The way it went down, obviously, was that they were not able to offer those religious arguments against the anti-discrimination law. And I'm puzzled by the federalism argument that you were making, that should Georgia be able to have negotiated a settlement wherein the segregated restaurant could continue to be segregated?
It's a problem in this debate. We always go straight to race. Race is the extreme case in America. There is nothing else like race in America, like the history of slavery and segregation and Jim Crow and everything that went with it. And that's, once you get to race, it's very hard to get anywhere but to extreme black and white. So there are some differences. One is that when you're talking about a same-sex wedding, I've had one, I guess you've had one, you are clearly talking about something with religious implications and that implicates religion in a very deep way, right? 2,000 years of Catholic theology, for example. That is not true of some racist who says, no black people can eat at my lunch counter. And there is, in my opinion, in modern America, no legitimate religious doctrinal support for racism.
So
there is, however, a very long and very deep history on homosexuality and religion. I don't like where the Mormon Church is, where the Catholic Church is, where Islam is, and where Orthodox Judaism is, but that is where they're there. and that is real theology. And when you're talking about a gay wedding, you're getting to that.
I guess I want to give the religious racist a little more credibility than that. First, just doctrinally, notice that, you know, courts never want to actually decide whether a religious belief is sincere enough. That came up in the Hobby Lobby case. I mean, is it really a violation of someone's faith to offer insurance coverage that someone else may use to purchase contraception? I think, you know, my background is in religious studies as well as in law. I don't think that's theologically coherent, but courts never want to do that. And I think Mark and I would agree. We don't want courts deciding when somebody else's religious belief is sincere enough to be protected. And I do actually disagree. Obviously, race is different from sexual orientation and different from gender, different from immigration status. But there's a very strong religious-based ideology. God separated the races on the continents, the curse of Ham, that Ham was going to serve his brothers. This may seem kind of antiquated theology now, but you could hear it preached in, you know, in I don't want to stigmatize the South. Let's just say you could hear it preached in many places as late as the 1950s and 1960s. And so while granting that there is some distinction, although I'm not sure we can precisely identify it, something about history, that between sexual orientation and race, I'm not sure that distinction is because there's not a robust theological racist tradition.
Go ahead, Mark. I'll follow up.
Two things. One is there's actually an interesting book which has the word stone or pebble in the title. I've forgotten about the role of the churches in Southern integration. And the theme of it, basically, I can't vouch for the history, but the author says that he was surprised to learn how little the white churches stood up for segregation by the time he got to the 50s and 60s. Now, that's not to say in the earlier they weren't. So there's some question about that. It's interesting, though, and I know this from the files of my former employer, when they were integrating the schools, and when that was the litigation of the mid-60s through the 70s, there was a lot of discussion of private schools, certainly in the South, the so-called segregation academies, but in the North as well, flight to Catholic schools and Jewish schools and the like. And the NAACP always toyed with the idea of including religious schools in school segregation litigation, because they were supposedly part of the problem. And somehow they never really pulled that trigger. And the Supreme Court has danced around it a couple of times and never quite answered the question. And in Bob Jones, which is a college and which is a tax exemption question, there they unequivocally said that religion was not a justification, at least it's not sufficient to get you a tax exemption. But it is interesting that at the height of the civil rights movement, the issue was real. It really had an impact in northern cities on the ability to integrate, and certainly in the South with segregation academies. And yet, people just weren't prepared to bring that litigation out. That may have just been a litigation tactic. It may have been a mistake in retrospect. But it is a fact that there are no such cases that I know of.
If this is like race for you, Jay, I mean, just to follow up on that a bit, there really isn't much room for religious exemption on any level.
Well, I want to say like and unlike. I think what I want to say is not that sexual orientation is like race. I think we know that that's not the case. There's not a history of slavery. There's not. It's not. The question is, how is it unlike and how is it like? And that, I think we could use a little more analytical precision in terms of identifying whether it's like race in this case for this question or not, even understanding that sociologically there's nothing like the history of race in America. And you know, but it's interesting, let's go back just to the question of private schools and integration. Under a modest religious exemption, again on the Venn diagram of modest to extreme, that would certainly be covered. So you wouldn't have a case where a gay student or the child of gay parents would be able to sue a parochial school or a private school of one kind or another if it was a religious school, religiously affiliated organization. The question is the next level of the Venn? Where's the next level of the Venn diagram? If it's a private actor, if it's a private
the trouble with that, Jay, is those lawsuits have already been brought. There was one in California by two students, although it's not clear that they were in fact lesbian. The principal thought they were, heard rumors or something. And there are a couple of cases now pending about Catholic schools.
I think this is the subtitle of the panel is common ground possible. I think it's clear, you know, you and I both been in the press on having different views on this issue, this might actually be a place where there is common ground. I don't think that absent public funding, and you know, that opens a whole can of worms, obviously,
yeah.
But absent public funding, I'm not sure that there's really the case that those two students in California would be able to bring, precisely so, because, again, in the Venn diagrams, that's close enough to the religious institution.
So two points about this. Robin, you want to go ahead? Or?
I'll go ask her.
I'm going to get off the law for a second, so I may be going in a slightly different
direction. Oh, can I go
direction.
First?
Yeah, you
go. Okay, just a couple quick. You, I mean, I want to take you up on the idea of adding a little analytical heft. But look, you know, Bob Jones, if you go back and you look at why that tax exemption was even in play, right? They talk about a measure, a yardstick of community conscience to be a charity, to qualify even as a 501c3. You had to be a charity, and so they use this measure of community conscience that they fell short of by having this particular interracial dating prohibition. And then I looked at all the Bob Jones subsequent cases and tax memorandum and tax guidances even, and, you know, rules that proposed about what we're going to do with the 501c3s on this afterwards. And they really have kept narrowly to the idea that it was about race and especially about education, which is why this last discussion is so interesting. But once you get outside of that, they're not just freewheeling going, hey, we're going to yank anybody's exemption when they don't toe the government line on what the ideology of today is. Now, many people worry about that, and I think there are some reasons to worry about that, given actually cases like the Ocean Grove Methodist Ministry, which is a very complicated case in New Jersey where a church-affiliated group that said to a lesbian, two lesbian couples actually, y'all can't use our very beautiful boardwalk pavilion for your, it wasn't a marriage because New Jersey didn't recognize same-sex marriage at the time, but for your commitment ceremony, we're not fine with that, so you can't do that. And that precipitated not only lawsuits by the two couples, but the state kicking this group out of something called the Green Acres Program. Well, I'm kind of okay with that because the Green Acres Program said these are public lands. And for me, public means public. That's everybody. And so if you say to some person, y'all can't come, but we're going to let these other people come, that would not be serving the public. So that was very much a quid pro quo program, and they lost that exemption. And then something spooky happened that has, in fact, spooked a lot of the religious right, which is that the local taxing authorities took the exemption from ad valorem tax. That's like the tax you pay on your house, you know, the big check you have to write, or you forget that you're writing it because it's in your escrow. But in any event, it's being written. And they yanked their exemption from taxes just on the pavilion. Now, in the last year, in a new article I'm doing for one of the Georgetown journals, we went back and talked to the tax assessor. And it turns out that the tax assessor for that town yanked their exemption because they themselves had listed themselves in a particular way, not because they were a religious group. So they weren't punishing them for being religious. They were punishing them for not getting with the program, the Green Acres program. And then when the group went back with the assessor and said, but we're a religious organization, it took some time, but it was reinstituted on that ground. So it's a very complicated case, right? And it kind of takes you all the way back to Bob Jones again. Like, unless you're dumb enough to tie your own exemption to something that says, we're going to be public, we promise, right? This has only been limited to race and to education. One other point, and we can talk about it later because I want to listen to Jonathan. But that's that this whole race analogy misses the fact that the fundamental Civil Rights Act that you talked about, Ms. Lewis, earlier, right, all included exemptions. We didn't call them exemptions for religious people, but we included exemptions even for people that we posited to be racist, the famed Miss Murphy, who runs a boarding house that has four rooms or less. And the Miss Murphy exemption is there in the Fair Housing Act. It is there in the Fundamental Civil Rights Public Accommodations Act. That's your Katzenbach versus McClung, right? It's in all of those places. And it has never been taken away. right? And the people that use it today are, in fact, religious people in many, many instances. So, for example, the cases run like this. There's a little lady who runs a boarding home out of her house, and somebody shows up who's unmarried and wants to rent the room, and she doesn't want to do that because she doesn't want people having hinky sex next door. My God, right? She's like, I'm not cool with that. And what she means by that is she don't want any kind of sex happening, right? She wants people who are married having sex there or not at all, right? And she's able to do that under the Miss Murphy exemption. Now, for me, Miss Murphy just doesn't have a great impact on society. These are a few people who are sort of dying on the vine, literally, right? And ideas are going to get updated. And at some point, people aren't going to be willing to say, I don't want you in the room next door because y'all are having sex outside of marriage. And you do better in moments of great transition, it seems to me, to allow these folks to live in peace with the people who won the victory on the civil rights.
So that's a nice place to jump off from. Jay, you said something that was interesting, which is we need more analytical precision. And I would argue we need less analytical precision. In fact, we need much less analytical precision. What you're hearing today is an effort by intellectuals and lawyers to come up with the right answer in a situation where there are no analogies that are precisely right, and there are not even any two cases that are exactly alike. We will never get the right answer in this room trying to slice and dice this and draw analogies. The only way to get the right answer is through a political process of balancing through competing interests. That means Mark often won't like the answer. He'll think it's insufficient. My gay friends won't like the answer either. They want to stop Catholic schools from firing gay teachers because they're gay. That goes really far in the other direction. But the point is, the one and only practical way to solve this in America is through the political process. And we can do that. We've done it on abortion. We've done it so successfully on abortion that most people don't even know that there are religious protections for example, Catholic hospitals. That's how well it works. We can get there on this issue, too. It's going to take time, it's going to take litigation, and especially it's going to take political compromise. But the key thing is not to short-circuit that project, either by us trying to figure it out in this room or by one side or the other trying to pick up all the marbles.
Well, I have a couple. I mean, you know, that's an appealing vision, but for two things.
I thought I'd hear a but.
I'm a lawyer,
you just
right?
Stop at appealing vision.
But then I would lose my law license. The only place I have ever seen the ACLU quote public opinion polls in determining whether rights exist is in the Hobby Lobby case. In every other case, the ACLU represents, or not every other case, in many other cases, the ACLU represents minorities, and their position is it doesn't matter what the public thinks. These are rights; they are protected against everybody. So, I think that is on both sides here. You know, we're a majority; we don't want same-sex marriage; we can ban it. And on the other side, we don't have to talk about religious liberty because it's discrimination. The project you're describing is in a different political America.
Well, you know, Mark, it just isn't, and the leading authority in the world on that is sitting to your left. Ask her whether religious exemptions amount to anything in the states that have passed them. I think she'll say a lot of them are quite significant. You may not like them, but they're the best you're going to get in a political environment. And what's your alternative to political negotiation?
Well, if there were, I've been privy to some of those discussions at an earlier stage, and it resembles nothing like the political compromises you're talking about, and this is regrettable on both sides. I long ago wrote an article saying to the Orthodox community, "You've lost." This is 10 years ago, I guess already, which is before the current upswing in support for same-sex marriage. So you've lost this battle. Seek exemptions. That's the way to go. Nobody in the Orthodox community wanted to pick up on that. Now that the political shoe is on the other foot, I don't see a lot of evidence that the LGBT community as a whole is interested in your project. But the fact is that's true of every issue in America nowadays.
So what's your plan?
So I think I'm not sure what the way forward is. I don't see coming to anything that in the current environment that looks reasonably like an acceptable set of tests. And I am not saying that everybody ought to get an exemption. I think what I want is the test of compelling interest, least restrictive means. I think that's a good way of deciding cases, case by case. I think that works better than grand compromises. And because the legislature can never foresee all the circumstances, and I like the method that's traditionally, at least in my lifetime, which is you look at an individual fact pattern. Is it really important? What are the costs of carving out an exemption, and can you do that? I think that works pretty well, and I think we ought to use it here as well as wherever else. And the results will be, I can calmly accept the results of that process. The idea that religious liberty rights should depend on whether you can persuade a majority of citizens that they ought to recognize them, we'd still have school prayer with people being allowed to walk out. That would be the political compromise on that. The decision in town of Greece is the sort of political compromise that you would get if you go through your process. That's not terribly satisfactory. I dare say what would happen to freedom of the press if we put it to that test. So, the sort of leave it to the political process. I think we've worked out a pretty good way of adjudicating these cases case by case. I don't see any reason to abandon it. We will lose lots of cases. That's fine. But the point is that both sides get taken seriously in that process. You don't get, or at least you shouldn't get, myths thrown at one another. You don't get absurd hypotheticals thrown around. They shouldn't work. Fear-mongering shouldn't work in a courtroom. And I think that produces, on the whole, pretty good results. Even if most of my career I've been, because of the appointments to the Supreme Court, I've been on the losing edge, on the losing side of a lot of church-state religious liberty cases. But so what? The process works.
Robin, did you want to get in on this? I'm going to go to the audience pretty soon. But did you have a?
I'll just say a couple. I don't want to take anything
because I promised the audience.
I know.
I don't want to.
Okay, a couple quick points. I'm a little more sanguine than Mark about the courts. I actually think legislators have the opportunity to speak to collisions that don't have to happen. So we can look at the Venn diagram, we can predict what kinds of clashes we're likely to see, and I think it's incumbent upon legislators to speak to whether they mean these anti-discrimination laws that were about burgers and taxis, in fact, to apply to marriage in specific instances, and they have. And I like those targeted exemptions because then we're not scratching our head later wondering whether businesses were entitled under RFRA, and we're not trusting judges to figure out what substantial burden is. I think they need to be sort of precise and targeted. And I think we're kind of slipping into something here where we keep talking about whether we can come up with the right solutions. In fact, we're not the ones coming up with the right solutions. The people who actually have to agree and compromise, legislatures have been doing a pretty damn good job of agreeing and compromising.
And judges.
And, well, judges too, sometimes after the fact.
I prefer politics, but both, both work it out.
Okay, fair enough. But in this particular context, right, just because you have communities that are deeply, deeply opposed to each other doesn't mean we can't reach compromises. They have been, in fact, being reached by legislators who have to figure out how in a plural democratic society we can advance and enlarge liberty to the maximum point for both people, right, both sides, all of us, to live together. And I think a lot of these guys are doing that. I spent the last couple of weeks with my mother in Hawaii and visited with Representative Marcus Oshiro and Representative Joe Jordan for 3 days. Joe Jordan, you'll remember, was a woman who voted against the same-sex marriage law because it didn't have sufficient religious liberty exemptions. And she's a person of great principle and shouldn't be vilified for that, right? And the one thing that came away from that conversation that was really striking for me as just an academic in the ivory tower, right, was their account of how all of these national groups, people who didn't have any truck with Hawaii at all, went pouring in there, and how many, you know, protesters there were on every side, and they were under tremendous pressure to try to find a way to balance these competing goods. So I think to some extent, the legislatures are doing a good job. We should let them continue to find their local solutions.
So really briefly, my last two words, which of course it's a lawyer's word, which means paragraph. just on the legislative piece, you know, there's not thinking big enough. That's right. There's this meme that's arising now that the LGBT movement should be gracious in victory, that somehow we've won, and now we should be more charitable to the people who oppressed us for 2,500 years, and we should, because now all of a sudden the tide has turned. And I just think that really needs a reality check. Right now, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, finally transgender inclusive, is going to die in Congress yet again, almost certainly. HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, the kind of leading mainstream LGBT organization, is backing a version of ENDA that has a very broad religious exemption, not just for churches, not just for religious organizations, but for religious affiliated organizations. So the left is already pushing what I would consider to be actually too large of a religious exemption in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which will still fail in the current Congress. This notion that gays should now somehow be gracious in victory, I think is wrong on every front. There's not a victory, there's not graciousness, and actually there's not a single case that we really are talking about that doesn't involve a third party being harmed. Nobody's saying let's forget about religious liberty, it's discrimination, but we are saying yes, it's discrimination. So now when we balance in, when we look at how big the religious exemption should be, we're doing so in the context of oppression, continued oppression, and whether that oppression is going to be given the imprimatur of the state or not. So that to me is the kind of the reality check. And I do think there's a way forward. I'm a nice Jewish boy myself, but with apologies to my fellow Jews in the room, it's render unto God what is God and render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. That to me feels like the appropriate line for a religious exemption. That when you're involved in a religious activity and you're rendering unto God what is God, great. And maybe with a small exception, like a Miss Murphy exception for the for the small businesses of the world, the wedding cake bakers who are horrified of doing a wedding cake. When you're rendering unto Caesar, when you're working in the marketplace, when you're Hobby Lobby, a gigantic corporation with millions of dollars in revenue, hundreds of employees, and a very politically active CEO who doesn't hesitate, as is his right, obviously, to use his wealth for political activism, when you're that big and you're in a commercial enterprise, then you don't get to claim that you should play by different rules from everybody else. So to me, that feels like a clear enough principle. Yes, obviously there are gray areas when there's state money going to a religious organization. So that's why lawyers have jobs. But to me, the principle feels relatively clear.
So I can't resist.
All right, go ahead.
I also have a law license. What I find infuriating about that formulation is that you shouldn't recognize exemptions when somebody's going to be hurt. But not recognizing exemptions hurts equally deeply to people who have deeply religious beliefs and are not prepared to bifurcate themselves. So I don't know what the answer is in individual cases, but we're not going to get to where Jonathan wants to get by saying that one side is hurt and the other side is just this big evil oppressor. Because the small photographer in New Mexico, whatever else can be said, I mean, I'm in favor of abolishing wedding photographers as a general principle. but that's not oppression in the same way that Hobby Lobby is.
So you guys aren't going to agree on this, and that's the point. You don't have to.
No, but
there's a process. He's not going to say that you're right and this is legitimate.
I'm not saying
he doesn't have to.
He doesn't have to say that I'm right. What I'm saying is we don't get to the discussion that you want when one side says I'm hurt and you're not hurt if we enforce the law.
That we don't.
Nobody's saying that.
You just said that.
Nobody's saying that. I didn't say that. Let's play the tape. Nobody's saying that.
It's a
saying,
brief one.
Yes, there is discrimination, and there is a religious liberty interest at stake. But yes, there's also discrimination. When Elaine Photography, which is as good a case as the religious liberty side is going to get, right? A sincere couple. It's a tiny business. It's wedding photography. All of that. Even then, and I would actually support a very narrow commercial exemption, like a Miss Murphy exemption for tiny businesses. But even then, what we're basically saying is if you live in Albuquerque and you're a gay couple, that basically in the Yellow Pages it says no gays allowed. And that to me is a harm.
Yes,
that
is
a significant harm.
There's harm on both sides,
that is
right?
A, right?
Well,
so
my only point is that there's harm on both sides.
Versus harm.
That's fine.
It's right versus right, and we have a process for that. But you don't have to agree going in on who's harm.
No, that's fine.
James Madison said disagree on that, and then we'll
we
work
agree
it
that there's harm on all sides. The question is to just say that there's a process. Right, but where do you draw the line? It's not black and white.
It's not up to us.
Nobody has ever said that there's only harm on one side or the other. That's a straw man.
What we're saying is
where does the line get drawn, and how much discrimination do we allow?
Right.
And that's the question. That's not saying that there's only harm on one side.
I agree with that formulation.
See, we're done. Let's go to these people.
I know.
Why would you want to break?
So there are microphones, and I'm gonna. I was just not going to stop this conversation earlier, so I apologize for that. But it was too good, and we had to have it. So we won't get to all your questions, but at the reception, you can ask more questions.
I can't see anybody.
I see someone at the microphone. I'm going to start over here, and then I'm going to go to this mic. I'm going to go back and forth. Yes, sir.
Thanks for taking my question, and thank you all for coming out tonight. No one's really talked about healthcare and when we have same-sex couples in healthcare. Just a general question, having more people considered as married, is that going to help our U.S. healthcare system in general, or will it be detrimental? Your thoughts.
Can I do a political thing and answer a tangential question, which is just really briefly, Jonathan.
I know no one's an economist or an accountant up there.
Quibble with one of the points. I actually think that using reproductive justice as an example of success for me in the religious exemptions area is really problematic, not just because Hobby Lobby is right now being litigated, but because it is basically functionally impossible to get an abortion in large swaths of the country, in part because of restrictive laws about licensing and things like that, and in part because of religious exemptions. As to Obamacare and the ACA, fortunately, I know nothing, so I won't address that.
That hasn't stopped anybody else in the country.
That's a good point.
I actually think if the answer is, do you have more people that are covered, right?
Young and healthy.
Hopefully healthy. But in any event, I think then you have more people brought into the system. Non-working partners, spouses, So I think I don't think that's necessarily bad. I hate to disagree with Jay after our common ground, but I'll send you some articles if you're interested in it about whether abortion conscience clauses, for example, really create access issues for women or in the healthcare context writ large. So, we saw, for example, lots of pharmacists saying, hey, I don't want to fill your script for an abortifacient or Plan B or Ella. Plan B is not an abortifacient. If you want an article on that, I can give you a new one. But Ella actually is, at least the way many religious objectors conceive of what an abortifacient
is.
It acts post-fertilization. So, many people, I think, reasonably feel that they can't facilitate that, and the science lends that to them. But it hasn't created any great, those religious exemptions, for example, for pharmacists, haven't created huge problems for women seeking access, because there are other ways to do that. First of all, have Planned Parenthood's very extensive network of abortion providers across the country where you can get these drugs. Many commercial entities, especially after the ACA, because they have to have coverage, they're more likely because of the market, right, to carry it. And then even then, really the problem is an informational problem. So a lot of times when people don't know where to find a script, they say, wait a minute, I just got screwed by the religious objector. But the truth is, what happened is they didn't know where they could go find that script. So I actually think it's an appropriate role for the government to try to reduce informational problems and informational hurdles to access. And we shouldn't be very quick to default to say, well, we have to make a religious objector eat it, right? And they have to get with the program, because if not, we'll have an access issue for women. You can have access and religious liberty, and they don't have to actually, one doesn't have to come at the expense of the other, but it takes some forethinking about it.
Okay, I'm going to go over here.
A source of the problem seems to me to be the overbreadth of human rights ordinances. Are they still limited as they should be to public accommodations? And if so, how is that defined such that it encompasses things that don't seem to be public accommodations, like, such as florists and photographers, such that such merchants have to participate in a ceremony of which they disapprove?
There's prior to the same-sex marriage dispute, there was a wide disparity in the state courts on how they read state public accommodation laws. New York reads it extraordinarily broadly, for example. The leading case is a dentist's office. In Illinois, the same dentist office is not a place of public accommodation. There, some of those are quirks of drafting, some of those are history, some of those are just, you know, what happens in litigation. And some states actually have broader statutes, like the federal 1981-1982, that protect the right to contract. Generally, Maine has a pretty broad statute for licensees of any state. So there's a wide range of results about whether the Boy Scouts are a place of public accommodation before the Dale case, before the Supreme Court said they had a right of association. California court said the Boy Scouts are not a place. Other states held they and the Little League are places of public accommodation. It's just been a subject of wide litigation across the country. I would think that most people today think that in any place generally open to the public, the criteria of race and sex and sexual orientation and religion and national origin ought to be protected against discrimination as the base norm, regardless of the idiosyncrasies of particular statutes and decisional histories.
You wanted to comment on this, Robin?
I did, but in a more roundabout way. So, you know, if you go back to the Abortion Conscience Clause cases, right, the very first Abortion Conscience Clause, the Church Amendment, came up in 1973, and I've been rereading the legislative history. And it was precipitated, not by Roe, interestingly enough, but by federal spending on health care facilities, these monies called Hill-Burton dollars. And just before the Roe case, a lady had gone to this little tiny St. Vincent's versus Thomas, right? She rolls in there and she's going to have a baby by C-section, says to her doctor quite sensibly, I want to be sterilized while you're doing all of that. And the doctor's fine with it. Hospital finds out and says, no, we don't do that. We don't sterilize people. So doctor sews her back up, sends her back home. She sues under Section 1983, right, which is a federal statute that says no one can be deprived of their rights under the law or the constitutions of the United States, quote, under the color of state law. And that's where the rub is, because the district court in Montana actually enjoined this little tiny hospital from ever refusing to sterilize another woman because they had received some like 2-3% of some small monies in Hill-Burton dollars, which were under the Public Health Service Act. They had a license to operate, and they were tax exempt. Now, that would make like everybody a public actor, right? And it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And then comes down Roe. And then you get this amazing debate and discussion between Senator Church and Jaffe and Rockefeller and all these guys going, whoa, now that is a big deal, because we did not give these health care dollars to build health care facilities, meaning to force doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers to perform abortions against their religious and moral convictions. And it's actually a statute it's interesting, because you can think of the Church Amendment as saying this was the limit of our intention with something good that we did in federal law. Right? Now, you could call that discrimination, saying to a woman, I'm not going to do your abortion, that's discrimination. Right? But I don't think it's discrimination when they clarify that their intent was never to reach so deeply into the practice of medicine as to force every doctor to do an abortion. just because a woman needed it. And I would argue that's not an access issue, and I've tried to show that in various pieces. So I think the problem isn't just these public accommodation laws, right? The problem, wherever you went, is the fact that, I can't see, I'm sorry, the real problem is the nature of the government pushing so deeply into so many things. And then there are all these tentacles, right, that allow people to bring very clever, you know, lawyers, not law professors, we don't like to sue.
They're not clever.
Yeah, that's probably not clever enough, right? But in any event, you know, there's this unintended consequences and then clever people bringing suit that I think gets you there.
The only comment I would make, I mean, first of all, I love those cases because my federal court professor was an unreported opinion. It was my federal court's question with Herb Wexler, who was like one of the giants of federal court. And my answer was, I had written a law review article about it, and I said, you got the facts wrong. And that was all I wrote about that test, and I passed the course, which I'm astounded at my own chutzpah. The point I would make about this is it's a very big country. And we tend to forget sometimes that it's a very big country, which is not all of one piece. So when I'm sitting in Manhattan in my office and I hear people talking about, well, if the pharmacist won't fill your prescription for contraception, you know, you're not going to be able you're going to have this tremendous burden. Of course, the big problem in Manhattan is every second store is now a pharmacy. So that doesn't ring true. But if you're in Montana, mm-hmm. where the nearest pharmacy is 50, 75, 100 miles away, and you're a teenager and you don't have a license or you don't have the gas money to drive 150 miles to get Plan B, that's a very different kettle of fish. And the same will be true of abortion. In New York City, if a Catholic hospital won't provide an abortion, except for a narrow number of cases where it's, you know, on the table and you've got to make a last-minute decision, and those things happen, basically there's another hospital a couple of blocks away that you can go to. That's not true if you're in South Texas or in Idaho or some other place. So it's not necessarily true that you know, people say it is accessible or it's never accessible. It just depends on where you are in the country, and things are going to look different in different parts of the country. I think we ought to take those things into account.
And can I say that the exemptions that my group proposes would be qualified by hardship? In the case of the mom-and-pop businesses to same-sex couples that are in, you know, BFE, Montana, and there's one photographer, or in the case of a pharmacist.
Am I the only person on this panel who's actually lived in Montana? I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There's plenty of pharmacies.
I love it. In any event, okay, so enough about Montana. But it, you know, honestly, you can, look, it isn't an either-or thing. So you can say we'll have as much religious liberty as we can stand up to the point of where it creates real access issues for the women trying to get the abortion or the script or whatever the particular service is. And then in my particular case, I have argued that the right to say no to that abortion has to be qualified by the fact that the person in front of you, in fact, might die. Right? Now, that said, we're too quick to just tell religious objectors to get over it, right? So in Mount Sinai, a case that came up...
I was trying to interrupt you.
Okay, never mind. I'm done. I'll tell you about Mount Sinai later.
Well, I'd like to keep going, and this has actually segued into a panel about other issues as well, but they're all circling back to where we started, which is, I know we're over, I'm going to try to sneak in one more question because I feel guilty not getting to the audience earlier.
We'd like you to feel guilty, Charles.
I know. You've been doing this for many years. Yeah. So one more question, then we're going to wrap.
Yes, my name's Sebastian with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. And it appears to me that the whole discussion was taking place in a silo. We discuss gay rights as if they're independent from women's rights or race, as a matter of fact. And when someone mentioned race, they were immediately, well, race. I think that we really need to understand that there are black people who are LGBT, and we need to address them as well as part of this movement. And that said, we can't cite LGBT without properly addressing lesbians and transgender particular needs, right? Because it seems that this was very focused on gay marriage as opposed to addressing high HIV rates and how religious refusals are not providing preventive HIV care because they don't want to provide PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis medicine, because, God forbid, a sex-positive culture. And so I think that we're not truly addressing how religion and faith groups could work together, especially as an undocumented immigrant. You know, I know that religious groups like the Catholic Charities have been instrumental in propelling the immigrant rights movement that is an LGBT rights movement. And so how are you as panelists of such diverse backgrounds addressing the actual needs of the overall LGBT populations that are as diverse as America is? And so it's no more gay marriage, it's immigration rights, it's civil rights, and abortion for corrective rape victims who are lesbians in many cases and have need access to these procedures, or sterilization procedures among trans men, or hormone therapy among trans women, which are all being sometimes neglected by extremist religious groups. So that's my question.
Thank you. So I'm going to give everybody a chance to comment who would like to on that question, and we'll wrap up.
It sounded like a statement to me.
Okay.
I think that's right.
I want to know more, actually, after, if you would just let me. I was curious about the HIV rates and the refusal, so.
Well, how could we incorporate it in a more inclusive manner, a gay rights rhetoric that incorporates minorities within
Factor? I'll speak to intersectionality for a second. As you might know, I worked in that area for a while when I was working at a large funding foundation, which focused on the intersections of racial oppression and homophobia and other forms of oppression. So intersectionality is the real reality that there's nobody's ever in just one particular vertical. It was one reason that I chose to bring in the destructive other subject of reproductive justice or reproductive health, destructive only insofar as that's all we then talked about mostly for the next 15 minutes or so. But I did do that consciously. I think even the framing of the Charles, and I had some words earlier about the use of the term gay rights, which is not a term I'm particularly enamored of. If we're talking about equality or justice, these are the words that I tend to use and language that I think are preferable. But I think that actually points to a much larger point about the shifting, not just the shifting demographic trends in America, but the way in which some of these issues do get represented. It's interesting that a lot of the same-sex marriage cases are not actually about same-sex marriage, that they're, you know, like the case in New Jersey, which was not about civil marriage. And I think it's certainly the case that some of the issues of inequality regarding LGBTQ people, that some of the ones that you addressed that intersect with vectors of economic injustice, are some of the most acute, and they also don't tend to fit into some of the frames that we've talked about. And it is really a challenge sometimes in coalition building, where sometimes then an ally in one particular political struggle may become actually an adversary in another one. But I do think that we did actually get to a place of some common ground, even here in this panel, and we weren't able to bring in each of the not every group is represented adequately on this particular panel, and not every perspective was either. But of the limited subset that were, I think it's actually it's always useful to deconstruct the or the and. I think here this one was an and: gay rights and religious liberty. Certainly, the numbers in religious communities that are increasingly inclusive of LGBT people are increasing. And it's even, I think, the more interesting conversation that we're just getting ready to have actually is the intra-religious conversation about questioning some of these issues as moral questions, not as legal ones. Because that's where the courts should not be going, right? But in communities of faith, to actually look at the sort of moral questions of providing healthcare options, what is my moral culpability for providing an insurance plan when my employee then utilizes it in a particular way that offends some belief that I have. Those are actually, to me, really interesting, juicy, religious, theological, sociological questions that are distinct and should be distinct from the legal ones that we've mostly described. So thank you for your question or statement.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being here, but I also want to say that I think that the panel has demonstrated how important it is to have these conversations, not only because there's so much to say and we don't have enough time to cover even what we needed to cover tonight, and so it's not only that, it's because we just don't have enough of these kinds of conversations. And I think one of the reasons that from my perspective, some of the what happened this spring happened in Arizona and elsewhere is because really people have been speaking past one another or shouting past one another on these issues and not finding opportunities to really sit and work on these things. Mark may be right that some of those conversations have not been useful, or Robin may be right and say they are useful, but I think that we need to try harder. And I'm happy tonight that we started this conversation. The last statement that was made from the audience reminds me that we need to do more here, to have more conversations with a wider circle of people on these issues. And so I want you to join me in thanking what I think is an outstanding panel for their great conversation.
Thank you, Joe.
We have a reception for you, and I hope you'll join us for the reception. We also, you've gotten Moment Magazine, you've gotten handouts, but there's another resource as well. We have Jonathan Rauch's wonderful book, Kindly Inquisitors, The New Attacks on Free Thought, which is, I think, one of the best books ever written on free speech.
One of.
I was going to say the best, but I just, you know, there may be people in the room. But it is an outstanding book on free speech. If you're at all interested in the larger questions, not just legal, but the moral questions, Jay raised moral questions at the end, this is the book for you. And so that's going to be available at the reception as well. And again, I want to thank Moment Magazine for collaborating with us on this evening. Dean, did you have something you wanted to say at the end here?
Thank you, because it was such a magnificent conversation. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for doing it.